And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As the November elections approach, there may be two fundamental visions of our future. One would suggest that our beliefs and values should shape our decisions above all else. Another acknowledges that a diversity of values and opinions define the American experience, and we must base our decisions on science and truth to assure the continuance of the opportunity to express our varying values. This just may be at the core of the Kemp Thorne strategy. We find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Well, now we continue our show about changes that are being made at the executive levels of our government, passing these changes down into the various agencies, specifically the changes that Dirk Kempthorne has mandated are related to review of projects around the country that could have an impact on endangered species. And to continue this discussion, I now want to welcome to the show Kieran Suckling, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Biological Diversity. Kieran, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
I received a press release about this particular change by Dirk Kempthorne with the Department of Interior. Could you give us a brief summary of your concern of the changes?
Yeah, he made two changes. They're both draconian and I think would reverse the 35 years of progress we've seen on endangered species. The first is to remove the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as an independent auditor of other federal agencies and allow those agencies to make their own determination about whether their projects are going to hurt endangered species. So, for example, if the Bureau of Reclamation is going to build a dam, currently it would need to get the outside approval of the Fish and Wildlife Service before doing that. And since the Fish and Wildlife Service has no financial stake in the building of that dam, it's in a place to give an objective opinion. But if you ask the Bureau of Reclamation, which is building the dam, to then judge whether the dam hurts endangered species, it has a massive and obvious conflict of interest, and so it's always going to come back with the decision that no, this is fine. In fact, over the years, we've seen that the Fish and Wildlife Service very often disagrees with these agencies on the environmental impacts, and that disagreement proves its objectivity and its need to be present in this process. So basically, Dirk Kempthorne is really proposing now to put the fox in charge of the proverbial hen house and turn over endangered species decisions to agencies who have a financial incentive to harm those species.
I was trying to think of a good analogy, and I thought of the idea that it's sort of like talking to a drug addict and saying, look, we're going to let you make a decision about whether or not you think you need some more drugs.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Or another one, if you look at what just happened with our whole mortgage meltdown. What happened there was the mortgage companies had a financial incentive to give out bad mortgages.
Sure.
When they should have been objectively reviewing these and saying, no, this is not a good deal. So, I mean, it's a form of deregulation is what it is. And in fact, what's very interesting about this is that the Bush administration did a test run of this concept the last few years with logging in western states. The results were absolutely dismal. The U.S. Forest Service violated the Endangered Species Act the majority of times when allowed to do its own review. And so then the Bush administration suppressed the report showing this and instead proposed to expand it nationwide. So they already know that this proposal will fail for species, but they don't care because their measure of success is that it produces more timber, more mines, more natural resources. As far as they're concerned, it's a success that the species got harmed.
It's all about winning.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, it's not an even playing field any longer. The rules have changed.
Not at all. And then let me tell you about the other change to put in. So when the federal agencies are supposed to make this determination of whether or not their actions are going to drive species extinct. They have to do so under a certain scientific standard. The administration has, as a matter of policy, now said, oh yeah, and by the way, greenhouse gas emissions, no matter how damaging they are to endangered species, are off the table. So you're actually banned from even attempting to review the impact of global warming on endangered species, which is absolutely crazy given the fact that global warming is shaping up to be the single biggest threat to endangered species. And now we're banning the agencies from actually even reviewing that problem. It's extraordinary.
We're hopefully at the end of this run. One can certainly hope that there will be a change somewhere by either candidate. I'm not even going left or right. I'm just saying.
I think that that's right. Regardless of whether it's McCain or Obama, there's going to be a change for the better. I mean, McCain and Obama are very different in their positions, but I think both are considerably better than George Bush, that's for sure.
I certainly hope that somewhere in this campaign, someone actually asks both candidates whether or not they support this change, because I think it needs to be on the table.
And this did happen, actually. The Associated Press asked Obama what he thought of it, and he basically said, this is a disaster. It shouldn't happen. If it does happen, I'll try to reverse it when I get in. The McCain camp had no comment, and I don't know if that's because they just didn't know what the deal was because it had happened so quickly, or whether they were seriously considering it. It's difficult to tell.
To me, it's a defining aspect of the difference in the campaigns, that in terms of just a vision about where America should be going and how that can happen. Thank you for that information. I may call up the McCain campaign and ask that question.
Initially happened right after the policy came out. So if we're fair to McCain and say, well, he just didn't know what it was. Well,
fair enough, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's been a week now. Mm-hmm. So he should have figured it out by now, and let's see what his position is.
We don't have to go real political here, but, you know, there are realities as well. And unfortunately, one of the mantras that is swirling around the McCain campaign is drill, drill, drill. And that has direct impact on the things we're talking about here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the driving force behind these changes is the Bush administration's correct perception that the Endangered Species Act is finally starting to get a little toehold in on oil and gas drilling, mm-hmm. and they can see down the road and go, yeah, okay, a decade from now, it's going to be a major, major issue. There's going to be no oil and gas drilling that doesn't go through very substantial endangered species review. So they're trying to put the finger in the dike right there and cut that off. So I think that it very much does tie back into positions on oil and gas drilling.
One of the things that concerns me, and I've been doing the show here for about, it's going on 5 years, and the changes that I feel conscious of, I'm not comfortable with, because I think we're just headed down a slope here. And one of the things that concerns me very much is the fact that even within the environmental community, environmental issues have been completely co-opted, and in to a certain extent, rightfully so, by the issue of energy independence. But therefore, the concept of biological diversity or the importance of the natural world is completely off the table.
Yeah, I think that's right. I was disappointed, to say the least. But I think more than that, even just really sort of taken aback by how quickly the debate turned from what should a global warming bill look like under Lieberman Warner, to how quickly can we drill for oil?
Absolutely.
And it was, I mean, it was like 1 week, we're debating this very large bill, which would have huge structural changes to our economy. It goes down, and then gas prices go up, and all of a sudden we're talking about the exact opposite proposal. And the Dems, frankly, did a very poor job of taking the high ground and saying that these high gas prices should spur us away from oil. Instead, they got sucked into it, and just a couple of days ago, Pelosi actually came out and said, now we'll entertain a bill to expand oil drilling offshore. We're actually going to reverse the policy put in place by the first Bush administration.
I don't see I'm getting a little depressed in the sense that we're, in some respects, we're losing the battle, and the battle has to do with biological diversity. Well, I'm totally in accord with what you guys are all about, the Center for Biological Diversity. That's critical to our survival. It's the all of life depends on.
Oh yeah, I mean it is the very foundation of life on this earth. In fact, I'll tell you how foundational it is. The very oil that we're putting into our car is the decomposed bodies of plants and animals. Plants and animals make everything human.
And coal and natural gas.
All of it.
Yeah.
All of it,
exactly.
You know. And it's a huge concern to me because I track every single endangered species in the United States very closely, and quite a few in Canada and Mexico. And one of the things we attempt to do is really gauge the year-to-year changes in the population size of the species and whether they're recovering or not and why. And one of the things we've seen is that once a species is put on the endangered species list, its decline toward extinction usually stops, and the majority of them start increasing in population size. Some fairly rapidly in California area, for example, you got the California least tern, huge population increase. Some much more slowly, like the condor, tremendous amount of work. It's kind of a day-by-day thing, but it's the right direction. But all of that progress over the last 35 years has come from these strong policies requiring that the Fish and Wildlife Service serve as an objective outside judge on impacts to the species. And so by taking that away, we are taking away the policy that we've seen help species, and I very much fear that all these gains are going to be reversed very quickly. And for some of these species, there's just no room for reversal. I mean, if you've got a fish that's down to 200 or 300 fish left, 18 months of bad policy can drive it extinct. It just does not have the buffer room to make a mistake of this caliber and come back and fix it 3, 4, 5 years later. It's not enough time.
I think one of the questions that people might have is, why is diversity so important? Let's go a little bit esoteric.
Sure.
Here. I mean, I think it's until we're able to really recreate that awareness, and I do think there was a period of time when people did have that sense, but it's just so far off the table. How can we get people to realize just how important diversity is and how these differences in the regulations are going to affect the capacity for this diversity to maintain?
I think one of the key things, one of the things most interesting to me, and I think most biologically important, is that what we're fighting over here is not simply this or that plant or animal, but the whole concept of diversity and biological diversity. Because our ecosystems, our natural world, works best and is able to produce clean air and clean water when it has a diversity of species on the ground, that they give the whole system great stability. So as we start to lose populations or entire species, there's less diversity out there, which means that the systems become much more unstable and are likely to degrade. I'll give you a metaphor here. I think it's actually not entirely a metaphor. I actually think it's part of the same broader ecological concept. But in a political system, if you have multiple parties, diverse opinions, that system tends to be stable because no one position is going to dominate and take over. And consequently, the political systems tend to be moderate and democratic. If you've got a political system where one party runs the table, that there is no diversity, it tends to veer off toward tyrannical states, towards very unstable systems. And so just as in politics you want diversity to sort of level the playing field and provide checks and balances, it's the exact same thing in the environment. If you have 100 species out there, well, a disease that comes through may only affect 10 of them, and so you've got 90 left, and so you've got some stability. If you reduce the diversity out there so there's only 10 species, and all 10 get hit by the same disease, you have a ecological collapse. So it's very important that we keep this broad diversity of species, especially somewhere like San Diego. San Diego County has the highest biological diversity in the lower 48 states. It's extraordinary. You just drive around from the coastal sage scrub up into the chaparral, up into the mountains, and you're constantly passing by species that exist nowhere else on Earth.
Amazing 60-mile drive.
Yeah, it's just incredible. And so, but it also means that what's at stake is much higher there. What can be lost is much greater. And I think that San Diego County and five or six other places in the entire country should be at the top of our list for state and federal funding and management plans to preserve that diversity, because it's once it's gone, can't bring it back. And that's what's unique about this issue. If you have polluted air or polluted water, you can say, okay, we made that mistake. We're going to clean it up now, and 5-6 years later, your water's cleaner. But if a species goes extinct, you cannot reverse that mistake. Mm-hmm. It's an all-or-nothing proposition. And so we need to work very, very hard to ensure that that never happens.
Kieran, one of the things I'd love to talk with you about is where you see the trends. I mean, for example, one of the stories that I keep hearing about is what's happening to the amphibians. Now, I know that when I was a kid growing up in the Midwest in Minnesota, Wisconsin, gosh, you go out to any kind of pond or something, and it was an amazing reality out there. I believe that that's changed. You have the information. Let's talk about amphibians first, because I do hear a lot of stories about that. But then any other classes or whatever that you feel are really being impacted, and perhaps why?
Yeah, the amphibians are one of the most endangered group of species. Actually, not the very most. I'll talk about another group later. But they're in tremendous trouble all over the world. And the reason for that is that amphibians occur in water and on land. So they are subject to threats on both places. Their skin is very permeable, and it tends to be wet because it's in the water, and that means that it's much more susceptible to air pollution and water pollution. When they reproduce, the way they do it exposes the sperm to the water. And so right at the very beginning of life, even just prior to life, if there is any water pollution, it's going to instantly impact the sperm of the species. And so for all these reasons, the amphibians are right on the forefront of whatever impact we have on the environment. And not surprisingly, they are in decline all over the world, all over the U.S. It's air pollution, it's water pollution, it's exotic species. A lot of chemical impacts are a real problem. One of the things that happens is all of the various medicines that we humans use, and very importantly, also birth control medication, gets flushed down our toilets out into the wetlands, and then these species are subjected to this chemical soup. And we're seeing deformed amphibians all over the country due to this chemical impact. People call it the endocrine disruptors. Basically, we're disrupting the species' endocrine system, and they're becoming deformed. And obviously, these deformed individuals can't live. So it's a tremendous problem.
So with the amphibians, water flows downhill. These animals live where everything ends up.
That's right.
And they, unfortunately, they can't escape it. They're not, you know, the amphibians are the new canary. They are telling us stories. They're warning us about...
Yeah, they can't get up
they
and
can't get out.
Fly away.
That's exactly correct.
They're right there. The another group of species, which is in even greater trouble, is our freshwater mussels. The United States is the epicenter of mussel diversity in the world. There are more freshwater mussel species in the U.S. than anywhere on Earth. They're primarily located in the southeastern states, Tennessee, Virginia, Kentucky, going into Alabama. The vast majority of all of them are imperiled. Many have already gone extinct. In fact, the biggest extinction spasm in the United States occurred in the Tombigbee River in Alabama and Tennessee. It's horrific. And what's happened there is that by building these dams, we prevented the mussels from being able to move upstream, and we have silted in their habitat. They need to have these rocky cobbles. Instead, that just gets all covered with silt and pollution. And then the water is chemically polluted, and it's a tremendous disaster. I have to say, as bad as things are in the West, I'd say there's a pretty strong general environmental consciousness there. There's a broad understanding that many of the impacts that we're causing should be stopped. In the Southeast, you just don't see that kind of level of interest. I mean, there's virtually no talk in the Southeast, for example, about removing dams that are driving species extinct, whereas there's a lot of discussion about dam removal from California all the way up to Washington State. So we're even farther behind the curve when it comes to river systems in the Southeast, and we're paying the price for that impact. But this is a very interesting example of the price that humans pay in this regard. Freshwater and marine mussels, they feed by just sucking water through their bodies and filtering out the nutrients in the water. So they're all like little filters. And these mussels, when they occur in the numbers that used to occur, which is the billions, they have the capacity to filter every drop of water in Chesapeake Bay through their bodies and clean it in a period of about 9 years. So when those mussels declined, our water, our natural water cleaning filter disappeared, and consequently the water is a lot more polluted now, and that is impacting fisheries of all kinds. We have huge human impact from driving these species extinct.
Coming back to sort of where we started out, this is the reason that good science is critical, because otherwise we're just guessing. We have no idea what's really going on. What's happened to the biological survey? At one point that was going to put all the biologists to work, going out and recording every living thing.
That's right.
What happened to that?
It got derailed. During the Clinton administration, Secretary of Interior Bruce Babbitt attempted to create a whole new agency, the National Biological Survey, and it had a very visionary agenda of really figuring out where all the species are in the country, what their management needs are, and provide the scientific information we would need.
It's such a beautiful concept.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, he proposed that at a time when the Republicans were in charge of both the House and the Senate. They crushed that idea, and we really just lost that whole concept and all the knowledge it would have produced. And I think science is critical to all of this. We just don't know what's happening with these species. We don't know what we as humans need to do to improve their lives unless we have scientific monitoring and research. And that's why I think it's no accident at all that at every single turn on the environment, what you see the Bush administration doing is censoring or even preventing science from ever being done. I mean, science is the enemy of the Bush administration on the environmental issues, because they can't control it. I mean, they want to have everything debate about economic values and tax incentives and all this kind of stuff where ultimately it's all opinion. I mean, there's no fundamental right or wrong there.
You're right.
They want everything to be in that realm of opinion. And so they just hate science. It informs debate and provides a basic bright line of what is true and what is not true, and the Bush administration views that as a terrible limitation on its power. And they're right. It is a limitation on their power. It's a proper limitation. And so consequently, Bush's war on the environment is very much a war on science. It's the same thing.
One of the aspects of the administration is a sense of supposedly a personal responsibility, that a person should have a sense of paying the consequences for their actions, except when it comes to these kinds of issues.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there is no way to monitor effectively the consequences of one's actions. I mean, for example, in our own health, we have a thermometer. You put the thermometer in your mouth and you know if you're healthy or if you're tending towards unhealth, you know?
Yeah, no, that's right. The Bush administration would say, you know, if you're sick, go watch Fox TV and see what their opinion is on your condition. You know, there's no monitor, there's no doctor. Yeah. And it's a disaster. In fact, we're battling that right now on a project in Texas where they are allowing this massive destruction of endangered species habitat on public land. One of the big legacies of the Bush administration is that it took a very successful program in which the military, for decades, was doing great things for endangered species. Turned that on its head and has really turned the military into an anti-endangered species agency. And we're seeing massive reversals of policy on military bases at great harm to native species. So in Texas, there's a big base there called Fort Hood. For many years, has done some great habitat management, increased the size of two endangered songbirds there, the golden-cheeked warbler and the black-capped vireo. Now the Bush administration comes in and says, hey, we're all about war. We have nothing to do with the environment. Why are you doing that? Let's reverse that. Let's now start destroying that habitat. As they proceeded, there were huge objections to this, and so the Bush administration set up this attempt to mitigate the damage, which was to basically pay private landowners to manage their habitat for these species in exchange for allowing the federal habitat to be destroyed. Well, I don't think that's a great idea to begin with, but even worse, going back to our science issue, they banned any public knowledge of where these private lands are, what the management on them will be, and any measure of success with the species. So they basically just said, we're banning all scientific knowledge that would allow us to judge whether this program works. You just have to trust us.
You know, I've never really put this out on the air before, and I don't know that I really believe it, but it's almost as if it's an alien species that's trying to decimate life on Earth.
Well, you know, that's funny you say that. I've heard that said many times in the environmental community. I mean, you do have the feeling that these people in charge of very, very high places have so little regard for life on Earth.
Yes, right.
That you look at them, you wonder, did they really come from here? Is it possible that an Earthling could have so little regard for life on Earth? Yeah. That makes you wonder, are they? It becomes the reasonable speculation at a certain point, because how else do you explain this just stunning lack of consideration for our very own planet and the 4 billion years of evolution that got us to where we are today?
It's hard to comprehend. I mean, it really is, just from a human perspective. I think about children these days, and, you know, I mean, the only hope that I can see at this point is, so hopefully, perhaps with the new administration, for there to be a massive environmental education and nature education strategy to rekindle a sense of wonder, because it's gone. It's just disappearing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all video games and stuff now. I mean, it's a very different world, certainly than the one that I grew up in. And I do very much worry about the amount of time kids now, especially young kids, spend on computers and TV and not out in the world looking at bugs and plants and things. It's a very big concern. I think that if we don't do a much better job of, it's not even so much education in the sense of, you know, imparting facts to them as just exposing them to the beauty and wonder of nature and let the natural human curiosity drive them.
Yes.
And make them appreciate what's happening, and there's just not enough of it. You know, I know that the Audubon Society has a big national campaign. I think they want to set up nature centers in every single urban area in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big multi-year campaign of theirs, and I think that's the kind of thing that can really help. I have a friend who runs a zoo in Phoenix, and they actually have kids come in and camp out for weekends inside the zoo.
That's great.
So those are the kind of things we need more of.
We need to get parents to just let their kids go out and look under a rock, to be honest. I mean, it starts right there.
Yes, no, absolutely. It starts right there. And even that, shockingly, is becomes more and more difficult. I know where I live. You know, I live out in the desert, and we've got rattlesnakes, and we've got scorpions. We've got all manner of things. But you learn to live with those things. And you teach kids, you know, what's dangerous and what's not. And too often I see parents that are just so afraid of the cactus spiders that they don't let the kids out there at all.
No, that is unfortunately. Everything has become dangerous.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I often get into very big picture speculation now, but I mean, so much of our politics, our economy, our consumerism is built around fear. And be afraid of this, buy this medicine, you know, be afraid of that country, vote for me. It's all fear driven. And so if you're bombarded by fear messages all day long of every kind by someone trying to sell you something, then it becomes very easy to think, oh, nature, dangerous, fearful place. Everything, don't put my kid out there. Well, and it's just a shame.
The messaging is terrible. I mean, and we're really wandering here, but it's important. Actually, what we're talking about is the basis of turning this around. We have to start literally on the ground, you know?
Yeah.
Kid comes in, and they're a little roughed up and a little dirty, and it's like, you know, you're dirty-ish, you know? It's not a good thing. Well, wow. We really took off there, but I guess the effort here is to get people to realize that that's where where we have to start the change.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I'll tell you one thing out there I find fascinating and goes back to the whole question of biological diversity. One of the things a lot of scientists and doctors are worried about on a very day-to-day level is we have these antibacterial soaps that we use everywhere now, and it's a real problem medically, because what happens is you're exposing bacteria to these tiny low-level dosages of antibacteria. Mm. It tends actually not really to kill them, but just to push them to evolve faster. And so we're undermining our medicines. But also, this is very intriguing. Mm. A bunch of studies now have found that when kids are exposed to the natural bacteria that occur in the yards where they live, it's very helpful to them. It builds up their immune system, and when they're not exposed to that, they have weaker immune systems. So if we're not letting our kids go outside, and then we're spraying these antibacterial soaps and wipes all over the house, kids are just not being exposed to what they need to be exposed to develop healthy immune systems. And what are these bacteria? Well, they're just other species. It goes back to biological diversity. Our interaction with these other species, in this case we can't even see them, are an essential part of our human health.
That is so perceptive, in the sense that in the process of trying to eliminate that diversity at that level,
yeah,
we're affecting our health in a negative way. The diversity is just built into the system, and it's why we're here.
Absolutely.
Why we're here. Well, amazing. Kieran, I really enjoyed this conversation. Here's one last question. Getting way back now to Dirk Kempthorne.
Yeah.
Do you know how soon these changes are supposed to go into effect?
Well,
and then also, what is the possibility of them being rescinded?
Well, they're supposed to go into effect in approximately 25 days, which is extraordinarily fast turnaround time, which really tells you these guys are trying to shoehorn this thing in before they leave office in a dramatic way. Congress is now trying to intervene and demand a 180-day comment period. My guess is the Bush administration is going to blow them off, put these regs into place. At that point, you're looking at going to court and getting a judge to shut them down. So we're proceeding right now already to design the lawsuit to stop it. And then alternatively, Congress can pass a law overturning it, but that takes a whole lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
A faster effort would be for the next administration to come in and just revoke the policy, which would be its right. So at any rate, all those tacks will be taken at once, and I do believe that one or more of them will work. This policy will get struck down. It's just a question of how much damage will have occurred between now and then.
All the more reason why we need to change the agency directors, which comes from
the
top.
Yeah.
That's really what it, because they now have all the power.
Yeah, the agency directors, and then even at lower levels. I mean, I think one of the key things going to be the new administration coming in is for them to figure out who are the really bad actors, because sometimes it even occurs at lower levels. In your neck of the woods, frankly, the director of the Carlsbad office of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is not anyone that should be allowed near any species, endangered or not. And so people like that are going to be needed to sent packing and replaced with people whose interest actually is science and conservation.
That's what we're doing here, trying to make that change, and hopefully we can. Kieran, why don't you invite people to visit the Center for Biological Diversity?
Yeah, you can go to our website, which is www.endangeredearth.org, and find all kinds of information about particular endangered species, what is being done to either hurt or help them, and find out more about what the center's doing.
Fabulous. Thanks so much for joining us here, Kieran. Kieran Suckling, Executive Director of the Center for Biological Diversity. Thanks so much.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. Invite your friends to come along as we explore the many voices and wonders of our lands, people, plants, and animals. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Tuesday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.